I'm calling the House Transportation Committee meeting to order. It's 1:29 on February 1st. This is our first meeting of the year, I believe, unless I missed the first one. Members present, Representative Colley and Sullivan Leonard, Representative Drummond, Representative Knopp. Representative Knopp is in the gallery. Representative Kopp is at the table. And also present is co-chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table if you need to pass a note. To committee members, do it through committee aide Laura Steidolf, who's sitting over here. I'd like to thank Sandra Edwardson, Transportation Committee Secretary, and Doug Bridges from Juneau LIO for their support. We have two bills on the calendar today, HB 263, Transportation Service for Hunters, and HB 259, Confining Vehicle Loads. We plan on holding them both. Our first order of business is HB 259, Confining Vehicle Loads. The intention today is to introduce the bill, answer questions from committee members, and set the bill aside. I'd like to also say that Representative Klayman has joined us. Madam Co-Chair, can we have a motion?
We certainly can, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for HB 259, Work Draft LS0917/T as a working document.
There is no objection. The work draft before us is a working document. Here to present the bill is Matt Groening. Staff to Representative Stutes. Department will be online for questions only. Daniel Loudon, Captain, Alaska State Troopers, Department of Public Safety. Dan Smith, Director, Division of Measurement Standards and Commercial Vehicle Enforcement. Matt, if you can come to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to present this bill today. I want to explain that there was the reason for the new CS being adopted is there was there was an error I discovered this morning, and it was just a reference to a section that we'd actually repealed in the bill, and that's the only change. So it's not a substantive change. It was just the removal of a reference of a repeal that was already in the bill. So before you today is House Bill 259, the unsecured load bill. And whether someone overflows the bed of their truck with rocks, gravel, plywood, scrap metal, loose debris on the way to the dump, or simply fails to tie down large objects in a flatbed, unsecured loads are an undisputed hazard to other users of the roadway as well as pedestrians. Improperly secured loads can cause serious injuries, property damage, and fatalities. The AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety concluded that from 2011 to 2014, road debris was a factor in more than 200,000 police-reported crashes. Those crashes resulted in approximately 39,000 injuries, 500 deaths, and additionally, the report found that two-thirds of those accidents were the results of items falling from a vehicle due to unsecured loads or improper maintenance. In another study by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, it was found that there were approximately 440 fatalities caused by roadway debris in 2010. That data was gathered by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. All 50 states currently have laws that require drivers to properly secure loads in any vehicle or trailer and impose fees that range from $10 to $5,000. In most states, failing to properly secure a load is a traffic violation. In Alaska currently, even if it results in the serious physical injury of another, is an infraction punishable by a fine not to exceed $300. However, 15 states have instituted possible criminal penalties for failing to properly secure loads. Last year, the state of Alaska, along with the municipality of Anchorage and the Anchorage Assembly, as well as the Mat-Su Assembly, officially declared June 6 as Secure Your Load Day by issuing proclamations and resolutions recognizing the hazards of failing to take simple steps of securely affixing every load. This is an effort that has been kind of going across the country. A lot of states have participated. In fact, I think in some form, all 50 states participated in Secure Your Load Day last year. We did get the governor to do a proclamation that also recognized, as I said, the state of Alaska's intent to increase awareness, to really educate the public on what a hazard this is. And basically what HB 259 does is it increases Alaska's standards for load securement of all types of materials and requires covering or maintaining 6 inches of freeboard with loads consisting of sand, dirt, rock, gravel, or similar materials. It also raises the violation of a Class A misdemeanor on the fourth offense or on the first offense if it results in the injury of another person. The legislation will decrease roadway litter, property damage, injuries, and fatalities on Alaska's highway. It's a responsible measure to protect the safety of Alaskan drivers and avoid costly repairs that result from the action or inaction of others. I would like to note that as invited testimony today, we have online Robin Abel. She's not only a nationwide expert and advocate regarding load securement, but she's also the mother of Maria Federici, who's the namesake of Maria's Law in Washington State, and we modeled this legislation closely off Maria's Law. And what happened was Robin's 24-year-old daughter, Maria, was struck by a piece of particle board that escaped from the back of a trailer in front of her, and she was nearly decapitated as the debris crushed every bone in her face, leaving her permanently blind, but miraculously she survived. At the time, there was no law addressing the consequences of unsecured loads, and the driver was cited for a traffic infraction and fined. Robin dedicated her life to changing the law, educating the public, and doing whatever she can to avoid this from happening to others. Thanks to Robin's efforts, Washington legislators adopted what's been called Maria's Law, which criminalizes a person's failure to properly secure a load that results in the injury or death of another. She's been leading the education and law-changing efforts across the country. She got a national transportation bill signed by then-President Obama, and that recognizes the need for reform in this area. But I'm going to let her tell the rest of her story. She's a pretty remarkable woman. Also in the room for invited testimony, we have an Alaskan, Kelly Roy, who flew all the way down from Anchorage to speak to us today about her experiences. And she experienced a very similar tragedy to Maria and is also fortunate to be alive. But I'm going to let her tell her story to the committee personally. I will say that Kelly is the impetus for this bill. She reached out to her legislator, Representative Ledoux, who as the chair of transportation forwarded this to us, and we took up the bill. Her story is a remarkable story, and her life has been forever changed. And again, in Alaska, there was no recourse besides a traffic fine. She's been leading the effort in Alaska to raise awareness, educate the public, and I'm truly grateful that she not only brought this bill to our office, but had the courage to drive down here and speak to us today. These type of situations, tragedies, sometimes it's property damage, but in this situation we're talking about somebody's life being irrevocably altered, and they're totally avoidable. It just takes the simple step, a few steps of making sure that what is in your vehicle is properly secured, and it doesn't matter what type of material that is. It's an easy thing to avoid, and I believe it needs to be changed. I will point out that in current statute, thumbing through my stuff here, and I'm just going to point this out because there has been the only concern I have heard about this bill has been from people that say, well, you know, we don't want to tarp our loads when it comes to rock, sand, dirt, or gravel, or we are abiding by this. The current statute right now, AS 2528-35251, contained or confined loans, and this is currently in law. A person may not drive a motor vehicle loaded with sand, gravel, rock, or similar materials on a highway unless the load is contained or confined to prevent the load from dropping, shifting, leaking, or escaping, except, and there's an exception there for basically road maintenance for sprinkling of sand and other materials for traction. But it says in B of that section, if a cover is used to maintain or confine a load being driven on the highway, the cover shall be securely fashioned to prevent the cover from becoming loose or detached or from being a hazard to other users of the roadway. This requirement is in statute right now. So I just want to point that out because I think some people don't realize that if you have dirt, rock, sand, or gravel that is escaping your truck, you are breaking the law. And with the chair's permission, I'd like to walk through the sectional analysis of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 1, or section 1 on page 1, line 3 through page 2, line 8, AS 2535251A is amended. Subsections A, A1A, A1A1I, and A1A2I on page 1, lines 4 through 12. These subsections specify that a person may not drive or move a motor vehicle, and we put the move part in to clarify that we're also talking about towing. That was already towing a load is in a trailer, just by the definition of what drive and motor vehicle was. The drafter felt like it was appropriate to put that in there, even though the law's always been applied as such. It was just a kind of a cleanup clarification they did. Loaded with any material, before it was just dirt, rock, sand, and gravel and similar materials, but we're trying to cover large objects that might be coming out of a truck that may be improperly secured or not secured at all. With any material on a highway, unless it is secured or situated in a way that prevents it from escaping the vehicle or shifting to the extent that the vehicle's maneuverability or stability is adversely affected. The previous statute had just said shifted, but we wanted to clarify that we're talking about shifting to the extent that the maneuverability or stability causes you to have an accident, essentially. Subsection A, B on page 1, line 13 through page 2, line 4. This is a subsection that it's an exemption that clarifies or specifies that a person may drive or may move a motor vehicle loaded with any material without the requirements listed above if the load is treated by methods approved by the regulation through the Department of Public Safety that are designed to settle the load or remove loose material before it is driven on a highway. I contacted DPS about this. They don't currently have any regulation to this effect in effect right now, but we wanted to transfer this over from the old statute. This is currently old statute. We wanted to leave them the ability to approve methods for treatment for those types of loads. Subsection A2 on page 2, lines 5 through 8, this subsection is an exemption that specifies that a person may drive or move loads consisting of sand, rock, dirt, gravel, or similar materials without the securement requirements if at least 6 inches of freeboard is maintained around the perimeter of the load. So they're still allowed a cone in the middle, but just around the perimeter. And freeboard, for anybody that doesn't understand the lip of the bed, the perimeter that's actually touching the bed needs to be 6 inches below. Or the load is covered and securely fastened. Section 2 on page 2, lines 9 through 30, that's the entire section. AS 2535251 is amended to add new subsections. Subsection C1 on page 2, lines 10 through 13, this is another exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to a vehicle that deposits sands, liquids, or other materials for the purpose of cleaning, maintaining, or improving traction in the highway. This is currently in the statute. It just got moved, so it's a new subsection, but this wording is in current law. Subsection C2 on page 2, lines 14 through 15. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of the Act do not apply to the natural accumulation of snow, ice, mud, dirt, or similar materials. And we wanted to make that clarification so that it couldn't be interpreted that a little bit of snow blew off your car. And anyway, wanted to make that distinction there. Subsection D1A on on page 2, lines 17 through 21. These subsections specify that a person who violates A, which are the requirements for securing your load, is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor on the fourth offense or on the first offense if it results in the physical injury of another. This is kind of an adaptation between the Washington state law and some of the other laws we looked at. Not to interrupt this, but I would like to note that in the Ledge Research Report, there is a comparison, basically, of all 15 other states that have passed possible criminal penalties, and you can kind of take a look at that and see whether you think that what we've done is reasonable.
We have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to interrupt your sectional analysis here, but I had a quick question while you're on this section here. So one thing is that you've highlighted the sense that violation results in physical injury. So do we have a way of quantifying that? I mean, you're saying serious injury, minor injury. How is that to be interpreted?
I have that, sorry, through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I have that definition. And I was actually going to point this out in my sectional anyway to give. This was exactly where I was going to do it, and it's good timing. I was going to point out the definition we have in the bill, and then give you an alternative definition so the committee could kind of decide which they thought was more appropriate. Right now, physical injury means a physical pain or an impairment of physical condition. And I'll repeat that again. That is an AS 11-81-900, and that is number 46. And that's B46. So again, it means a physical pain or an impairment of a physical condition. Now, there is another definition that the committee might view as more appropriate, and I spoke to the drafter about this yesterday just to give you some alternative definitions. Serious physical injury is also defined in statute, and that's on AS 11-81-900, and that is number 56. Serious physical injury means physical injury caused by an act performed under circumstances that create a substantial risk of death, or B, physical injury that causes serious and protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, protracted loss of impairment, or loss or impairment of the function of a body member or organ, or that unlawfully terminates a pregnancy. That is obviously a higher standard, and that I think that would be up to the will of the committee for what they viewed as more appropriate there. But I'd be happy to provide you that in writing, too, after the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just a follow-up question.
Yes, thank you, sir. Another question I had was with regard to the information we have in this particular packet. I see a lot of national data. Do we have anything from Department of Public Safety with regard to mirrored information?
I do have some data from DOT. I will preface it with saying it's largely incomplete because it only reports crashes that were reported. It doesn't get all the incidences, so it's only those that results in a crash. You don't have this in your packet, but I do have the information with me. With the chair's permission, I would like to state what it is.
Go ahead.
Okay. From 2003 to 2013, there was 189 crashes that resulted from load shifts. And what this it does not distinguish between a load shift in the vehicle that caused the accident and a load shift that resulted from an object directly flying out of a vehicle and hitting a car. But both of those are covered under the bill with our definition of shifting. So I've got it broken down by the seriousness of those injuries that resulted from those accidents, as well as which borough these accidents happened in, if you would like me to proceed.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Anchorage Municipality during that time period had 62 crashes that resulted from cargo shifts. Denali Borough had 1. Fairbanks North Star Borough had 20. Juneau City and Borough had 3. Kenai Peninsula Borough had 24. Ketchikan Gateway Borough had 3. Kodiak Island Borough had 2. Matanuska Susitna Borough had 34. They're actually the second highest besides Anchorage on this list. North Slope Borough had 1, Sitka City and Borough had 2, Skagway Municipality had 1, unorganized boroughs had 1, and non-borough areas had 13. There was 3 fatalities, 17 incapacitations, 6 possible injuries, 136 no injuries, 1 non-reported, I don't really know what that means, and 3 that were unknown. And out of the different causes of accidents, it ranks number 35 out of 68. So it's somewhere in the middle of the list, and I would like to preface it again with saying this list is it's not a real accurate reflection. It kind of gives you an idea that this is happening, but this would have had to have been reported as a result of an accident, which I think there's some of those that probably are not.
We have a question from Representative Klayman, and I have a couple questions.
Just for clarification, were those statistics referring to what you defined earlier from the statute as serious physical injury or just any physical injury?
I believe that I would have to clarify. I don't know. I got this data from uh, for the from the Alaska, just for the department behind me, I got this data from the Alaska Department of Transportation Public Facilities Crash Data Manager Division of Program Development, and it defines fatal and non-incapacitating. So through the chair, sorry, Representative Klayman, I do not know, to be honest with you, what non-incapacitating means, but I will follow up with the department and get you a definition.
Thank you.
I have a question then, Representative Drummond. The accidents that you just listed, load shifting, is that due to unsecured load or just any kind of load? I mean, if I have a load in the back of my vehicle and it's secured, but then it shifts, would that be a violation or is that just an accident?
If the shift adversely affected the maneuverability or stability of your vehicle and caused the accident, that would be included in that statistic. Certainly not just a shift, but this is either something leaving your vehicle or say you, and this is just a random example, but you have a small truck and you have a gigantic propane tank that's round in the back of your bed and you didn't secure it. Maybe it weighs 2,000 pounds and it, when you take a turn, it goes all the way over the other side, your vehicle swerves, and you hit another vehicle. If that's reported to the police as being the primary cause of that accident, and I will say that this only reports, I believe, primary causes. So this is the only data that I could find that was being collected to this effect in the state of Alaska. I know that on a national level, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration does quite a bit more extensive research into this. So I will see if I can dig deeper and get you guys some better specifics.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really interesting, this whole thing. We're talking right now we're talking about load shifting, but the guilty of a Class A misdemeanor applies if sand or rock leaves the unsecured load and causes physical injury. What if it just causes property injury, like, you know, cracking a windshield and there is no physical injury involved and you were able to track down the vehicle that loosed the gravel on you? Is that still falling within the range of getting a misdemeanor violation for an unsecured load?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, it is if it's your fourth violation, or it's a Class B misdemeanor if it's your third violation. The previous, if you've only committed this twice, it's a $600 citation. If you've only committed it once, it's a $300 citation, which is what it is in current statute. Mm-hmm. So it's a sliding scale that goes up mm-hmm. for repeat offenders.
Okay. But it does apply. You get a misdemeanor. You get a misdemeanor violation. Subsequent violations simply because of property damage and not necessarily causing a crash or physical injury to a person.
Through the chair, yes. If for repeat offenders, that is correct.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
On the misdemeanor charges, is there a mental state required?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that is not written into the bill. I would have to defer to somebody who knew the law a little better than I did to know if that was written into other statutes.
It's written in all kinds of places. Written in all kinds of places, but I'd be interested to know whether this is being treated as a strict liability offense because there's no mental state required, or if there is implied a mental state from other statutes, which mental state is applying.
I would have to check into that. I will get that information for you.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the bill presentation. I was just thinking of what examples do we have in the law now that would cover driving behavior and all that could result in injury or risk of injury to persons, and then also what are we driving at here? We have kind of looked at making physical injury a strict liability offense, as Representative Klayman was talking about it. If physical injury occurs, then you have a Class A misdemeanor. But in reckless driving, if a person operates a motor vehicle in a manner that creates a substantial and an unjustifiable risk of harm to a person or property, that is reckless driving, and it's a Class A misdemeanor. But actual injury isn't a requirement. It certainly is an element. It can be an element of proving the offense, you know, if someone wasn't. But how that statute reads is if the driver had to take, another driver had to take evasive action to avoid an accident. So if the big rock flies off, you know, you have to take evasive action to avoid something, that somebody's life was actually endangered or somehow their person was endangered. And then if that standard is considered too high in a situation, then the next lower one is negligent driving, where it's not substantial and unjustifiable. It's just an unjustifiable risk was created by the manner in which you were driving. And I'm wondering, you know, those are the two driving related offenses in the law, reckless driving being an A misdemeanor, where it's pretty specific on what has to happen to meet that A misdemeanor standard of driving. It would involve any control of the vehicle where the way you're controlling it has caused a substantial unjustifiable risk of harm to any other person. And then negligent driving. But then we also have reckless endangerment in the law, which has nothing to do with driving in particular, but has to do with all behavior, where if you are creating a substantial and unjustifiable risk of harm to another person or property by your behavior, whatever action you're doing. So I'm just wondering if we have something that can kind of take care of this, you know, that we currently have in the law, or not. Or we could certainly bring in some of the standards of driving if we're also want to justify the risk of harm rather than just say if there's an injury. I'm a motorcycle driver, so it's really easy to get hurt on a motorcycle. My fingers get smacked all the time from rocks, and I could say, wow, that's Class A misdemeanor, buddy. You know, a rock came out of the back of the truck, hit my finger, and it does happen a lot of times when you're driving a motorcycle. Or you get, you know, something hits you just under the bridge of the helmet, and it's hurts like the dickens, but I probably wouldn't think that it was misdemeanor. Maybe getting towards what Representative Klayman was saying, was the mental state there, was the person driving in a way that created a substantial and justifiable risk because the load wasn't properly secured? Well, maybe. I mean, that it may be justified. But when you're in a car, it's really hard to get that physical injury because you do have the windshield there. But if you're a pedestrian or a motorcycle operator, that threshold could be a lot lower. And so it's just things to think about. I think we're on the right track of protecting people, totally. I'm just wondering how to get that into the law, if it's covered elsewhere, or if we want to actually put into this section a person. So if you look at line 17, bringing in the language, is it a person who violates A of this section is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor and is punishable as provided in 1255. If the person who drives a motor vehicle in a manner has created a substantial and unjustifiable risk of harm to a person or to property, and we say it actually results in physical injury, you know, it would make this consistent with how reckless driving is defined. And we would be putting it in a kind of a DOT section of law, I'm just trying to. This is a driving offense. We have driving offenses elsewhere listed in the law, and I think the more homogeneous we can make the law so that the standards for when a Class A misdemeanor is applied is there's continuity within the law itself. It might be stronger statute. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I went on for a while, so thank you for that.
Thank you for your insight, Representative Kopp. And I guess I share some of the concern of the threshold of physical injury, which could be as low as physical pain, which, as Representative Kopp says, a pebble while riding a motorcycle is pain. Or to a pedestrian who's on the sidewalk, if a pebble, and I'm not downplaying it because there's certain injury that can happen from that, but I guess pain, you know, the threshold may be low in some circumstances, I guess.
Can I respond to that just briefly?
You may.
Thank you. Through the chair, to the chair, and to Representative Kopp as well, I think if I understand correctly, you would like it to be consistent with other driving offenses where there's the risk of injury and then the actual injury, as well as what I hear that the chairman saying, and that was kind of why I included that other alternate definition of a serious physical injury, because I actually, to be honest with you, had that same thought over the last couple of days as I was looking at injury, and I think the serious physical injury up to the will of the committee might be the more appropriate definition, and I think this all ties in, too, with Representative Klayman's question about whether someone's in a culpable mental state or what their mental state is. And anyway, I'll just want to make sure I understood exactly what we were getting at, but I think I would share your concerns on that as well.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sometimes it gets more complicated because the mental state question actually, in this instance, there is the mental state as to conduct and then a different mental state that relates to circumstance. And what I think Representative Kopp was talking about, although I don't want to speak for him, about some of the reckless driving offenses, that would be typically somebody that's going 80 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone, swerving back and forth. That's what is the mental state as to the conduct of how they're driving. In this particular bill, it's arguable that you're talking about the circumstance, meaning that I'm driving a tractor trailer with an unsecured load. So even if I'm driving on a 55-mile-an-hour road at speed limit, not swerving, not doing anything out of the ordinary, but I have an unsecured load, is that in loading the load, is that the conduct that raises one mental state, or is that the circumstance? And so if I'm aware that I have an unsecured load and I'm driving properly, what is the mental state I apply to the fact that I'm driving knowing this circumstance, even though the driving in and of itself, other than the condition of the load, may be perfectly legal? And that goes into those complicated questions of mental state.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. If, on the other hand, we're interested in changing the behavior of drivers with loads, I think they ought to be, police officer was to stop somebody who was otherwise driving accurately, and they had an unsecured load of some sort that clearly violated the law, I think they should, could they get a misdemeanor violation or some kind of violation issued to them that would keep them from accumulating so many or injuring somebody by continuing this kind of behavior? My goal would be to help change the behavior of drivers so that the guy who drives in an unsecured load once and doesn't injure anybody or cause a wreck will not be likely to do it again to the point that they injure someone else or accumulate three or more such violations.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, without trying to test my knowledge of the law, Representative Klayman is much more knowledgeable than I am on that. I would say you pretty much hit it 100%. We are trying to change the behavior of drivers, and that is the effort here. There's always the enforcement side and then the legal side, but our attempt here is to really change the behavior of drivers.
If I may comment, I think by repeated offenses, progressively goes to a misdemeanor. However, if there's physical harm, it could immediately go to a misdemeanor, and I think that's where the concern is, depending on the level of harm and perhaps mental state as well, that if it's something of a lower degree and suddenly someone has a misdemeanor for unintended, obviously not someone who's a flagrant serial load unsecure, anyhow. Representative Kopp.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I guess that's where I'm looking at this too. I do like the fact that this is progressive. You know, it's a violation like it is now, and then second offense, it doubles to $600. But because we are left with a strict liability offense of a Class A misdemeanor if physical injury occurs, which is a fairly low standard, there is, I'm imagining, several different scenarios where a truck could, an operator may have made a real attempt to secure the load. Maybe it's clear that they did. Maybe they hit a big pothole, you know, something shifted, and we've all seen that happen. And so that's where I was going with, if in the totality of the circumstances, it appeared that that operator operated the vehicle in a manner that created a substantial and unjustifiable risk of harm to a person or property, and it resulted in injury, then I could see where you could be at a, the fact that the risk they created was substantial and unjustifiable in the totality of circumstances, they didn't attempt to secure the load. It was more very haphazardly. But if you have a similar situation where there's an injury, where there was an obvious attempt to secure the load very responsibly, it failed somehow, you may have an injury, but we all may agree that probably maybe it shouldn't be a misdemeanor for a minor owie, you know. I mean, you know, just trying to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Through the chair, I'd like one comment. Point well taken, Representative. I agree with much of what you just said. This bill does go to judiciary next.
Oh, well, then I'll just be quiet. Maybe now's a good time to bring in some testimony.
We put time limits on people in judiciary. None of this law.
We have Robin Abel on the line. Oh, you're not finished. I'm sorry.
Finished.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right, I'm sectional analysis.
I'm almost done.
We got lots of
as brief as possible here.
Okay. Yep.
So moving down, and I believe we covered this essentially. So I'll go through it very fast. On the third offense, it's a Class B misdemeanor, and I do have, if anybody's curious, I have what a Class A misdemeanor and what a Class B misdemeanor are in statute as far as fines and imprisonment. But I will wait if anybody wants to hear that. Moving on to subsection D3A on page 2, lines 25 through 28. This subsection specifies that a person who violates the section the second time is punishable with a fine not more than $600. Moving down, it is not more than $300. Again, as Representative Kopp stated, is same as it is in statute now. So section 3 on page 2, line 31 through page 3, line 1. This is actually just a conforming amendment. The previously, it's to reflect the appeal of AS 2835251B and 2835255 in Section 4. 2835255 housed the penalties for both of those statutes. So when we repealed it, we had to put in a separate reference to make it clear that that AS 2835255 is still an infraction because we've removed both references of that. And if a member's references, if they're curious what that is a statute that requires anti-spray devices, fenders, flaps, or other devices to keep debris and water and such to becoming a roadway hazard. So that's just a conforming amendment. Section 4 repeals the two sections I just talked about. With that, I would be happy to answer your questions or at the will of the chair.
I think we've exhausted a lot of questions for now, so let's go to our testifier. Who's been waiting. Robin Abel, are you there?
Hello?
Robin, can you identify yourself and present your testimony to the committee,
yes,
please?
Robin Abel of Seattle, Washington.
And can you...
Hello?
Yep, you can present your testimony, please.
Great, thank you very much. Chairman Rolfe and committee members, it's an honor to be before you today, and I thank you for taking the time to listen to testimony on this load securement. It's become very dear to my heart. And I think one of you earlier hit the nail right on the head. This is all about changing behavior, and that's, you stole my first line, actually. So my goal here, and when I go out and talk, is I try to get people in the heart, to get them to feel compassion, because that is the only way you get behavior to change. So today I'm going to tell you a brief story of what happened to my daughter, Maria, why this law is so important, and what I've done over the last 14 years to make this easier for you to move forward to. So let me begin now. I got that call that every parent's worst nightmare. It was February 22nd, 2004. The phone rang, and it was Harborview Hospital. And this woman said to me, "Is your daughter Maria Federici?" It was the only time in my life I ever wanted to say no. I was always so proud she was my daughter. But I said yes, and she said to me, "She's in critical condition. You need to get her as soon as you can." Now, that wasn't the call I expected. It was Sunday night. My daughter was 25, graduated college, and had moved out the year before. But I threw on my clothes and got in my car and headed to the hospital, Harborview. Now, I had just made the loop onto the freeway, and I hadn't been onto the freeway maybe seconds, a few hundred feet. And I look off to the left, and there is my daughter's Jeep, Black Liberty, with a light shining on it, and there are ambulances and fire engines and medics everywhere, and the crime scene tape set up on the freeway. Now, I didn't know I would have to drive by the crime scene that night, and it took everything I had to make it to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, there was no one at the front desk, but immediately someone came out, and as soon as I said my name, all hell broke out behind the desk, and a woman came to help me, and she said, "We need to take you to a quiet room." Now, I had still not been told if my daughter was alive, and as this woman reached for the handle, I grabbed her arm, and I said, "Is my daughter still alive?" And she said to me, "I don't know." We went in and sat down. And it was not more than a minute or two, and two doctors came in. What I remember the most is their coats were clean and white, right? You're a parent. You're looking for a clue. There was no blood. It couldn't be that bad. But they didn't say anything. So finally I said, "Can you save her?" And they shook their heads no. And I thought, this can't be happening. This is Harborview. They're the best in the world. In fact, this is where you send your bear victims, is to Harborview Hospital. And so finally I said, "Are you sure you can't save her?" And they said, "No, she's bleeding out from the center of the brain. It's a matter of time." I looked down, and then I knew why they were there. I said, "Are you here for her organs?" And they said, "Yes." And I thought, my daughter would want that, and I would want that if it would just save a parent just a moment of what I was feeling. So I spent the next few hours filling out the paperwork. And my family came down to the hospital. My brother was going to take me home. And it was really on the way home that I found out what happened to Maria. She had been working one of three jobs that she graduated from the U, still holding it down, and she was a bartender at this particular lovely restaurant on the waterfront. And they had closed up for the night, and she was driving home. Now, someone long since ahead of her had lost a large entertainment center. It was black, 6 feet tall, must have busted up into parts. No one really knows. But the board that went through my daughter's windshield weighed 40 pounds. It was 6 feet long, 2 feet wide. And at impact, it hit her with 2,000 pounds. Now, hearing that, I thought, maybe it's best my daughter's gone that night. What would the quality of her life have been like? So it was about 7 in the morning. We were finally back at my brother's house in Port Orchard. And the phone rang again. And it was Harborview. They said, "Come back. She's still alive." Because I had donated her organs, they had reduced her temperature and saved her and kept her on life support. But when the doctors came in to check the charts that morning, they said, "Why is this young woman being given narcotics?" And the nurse said, "Because she's been in pain all night." And they realized she was still fighting for her life. Well, I have to tell you, Harborview pulled out all stops. The next few days were scary. The doctor said to me, "She will never see. She will never hear. We don't think she'll be able to speak. We know she has severe brain damage, and we don't know if she'll have any physical movement." Maria was an amazing young woman. She somehow, something was left in her soul. And these doctors, they pulled out everything they had. There were 30-some doctors at one point in the operating room on her. They recreated a whole new face from mesh wire, titanium, and from her own bone that they harvested from her head and her hip. They gave her a whole new face, and this board came within a quarter inch of completely decapitating her. It took away her whole face, from below her eyebrows to her upper palate. It was gone all the way back. They had to create everything forward. Maria lived, but her life will never be the same. She can talk, she can walk, she can dance, and she can hear like Spider Woman. You can't get a word, you can't say anything without her hearing it. She is blind. If you said that she looked different, she would say to you, "I'm just the same as before. I don't have a problem, you have a problem." So in that way, things are okay. But my daughter's life will never be the same. So let me tell you why I changed the law. Partway through, I realized, well, what's my daughter's future going to be like? How's she going to live? The surgery the first night was already would have taken my home. Within a few days, we were over $1 million. And so I called the King County prosecutor, and he was a wonderful man. He took my call immediately, and all I said to him was, please come meet my daughter and your client, Maria. And all he said was when and where. He was wonderful. He came to the hospital. He met with Maria. Now, I didn't know if she would yell and scream at him because she was going through all sorts of stages. But he was great with her, got her to say a few words, and then we went downstairs. And that's when he explained what happened to my daughter in the eyes of the law was not a crime. It was merely a littering ticket. Well, I can imagine, as your parent, most of your parents, it was hard to hear. So I said to him, well, it may be too late for my daughter, but it's not too late for others. And he said to me, you know, if you come back to me, I will help you. 2 months, I was back in his office with a draft of a bill. He found someone in the House and someone in the Senate in Olympia. And our bill passed on its first time through. And there were very few changes. But I was also very public about this, and it was news all over what happened to my daughter. I think what scared the public so much is my daughter looked like she could have been your daughter. And here she was, so beautiful, and yet her life has changed in an instant for something she had nothing to do. So here's what the law says in Washington State. If somebody is substantially injured, then it's up to a year in jail and a $5,000 fine. If property is damaged, then it's a $1,000 fine and 90 days in jail. A ticket for an unsecured loan is a ticket. But the reason I did this was not about jail time. It was not about getting even with anybody or making them suffer. It was about making the law tough enough to get people's attention because we are very cavalier about what we throw in the back of our trucks. Like, it's almost a secret right. I have worked very hard to educate the public, and it was really out of a promise to Norm Mailing. The prosecutor helped me. He said to me, you know, Robin, we can change all these laws, but the hard work begins when you have to educate the public. And I promised him at that point, and that's why I'm doing all of this, is out of that promise to him that I would stand behind the law, honor it, and educate the public, because that's where the tough work starts, is educating the public. So let me tell you a few of the things that I've accomplished on a national basis. And when I say we, I'm just one person, so forgive me. Changed 2 Washington state laws. I have had language in 2 national transportation bills, 1 getting the GAO to do a study, which is important. There was no data on this in the beginning, and that's probably why Matt is struggling to give you information. There's been very few data because it was never a big issue to anybody. I've also gotten language in the second transportation bill, I think it was 2012, where it stated the government acknowledged that there was a serious hazard because they had the report back, that there was money available, and they encouraged the states to do something about it. So the money's available. I've also changed the Washington Driver's Guide on Secure Your Load and then turned around in the recent revision I did and sent it to AMVA, which is your American Automobile Motor Vehicle Association. They approved it to go nationwide in a model manual for all non-commercial drivers, and that was sent out last summer to all the states. A lot has been accomplished, but there's still a problem, and while half of the states have laws in some way, whether it's a state law or ordinances, we had a road check, International Road Check 2017. It was June 6th to June 8th. And as a nation and beyond the borders, because I think it included Canada, load securement was the second highest out-of-service violators for that whole campaign. It was 3 days. And the reason I bring this up is the sad part was it was emphasized that the whole road check was going to be, the emphasis was load securement. And everybody knew that going in, and yet still it across our borders, we failed. And so my point is we need to educate. It's all about education. People don't go out to cause this problem. They just don't know how it applies to them. And they just don't think that thing that they put in the back of their truck when they have to slam on the brakes or swerve goes through someone's windshield. If I could leave you with one thing, it would be to say, secure your load as if everyone you love is driving in the car behind you. You have to think of those behind you. If it's not enough about saving lives or injuries, as a nation we spend $11.5 billion a year on picking up litter and litter programs. And we've been told it's about 20 to 40%, and some groups think it's even higher, that comes from unsecured loans. Now, that's a lot of money we could all use to do maintenance and fill potholes. I do have a website up, and you're all welcome to look at it to see what's been done. There's some things that maybe you guys could look at and use. But the one thing that I will ask you this, and I was afraid I'd forget it, is what are you all doing on June 6th? The reason I say that is June 6th is Secure Your Load Day, and your governor signed a proclamation last year saying June 6th is Secure Your Load Day. I had 47 states and the U.S. Virgin Islands participating last year. So this is my ask of you, besides the legislation. As a committee member and as a chairman, would you write your constituents and educate them on that day? Because you can reach so many people, and that's what this is all about. It goes way beyond changing the law. It goes about standing behind it and educating. So with that, I'll end with just one more comment. You have a young lady before you in the committee, Kelly Roy. She contacted me several years ago. And what I have to say about Kelly is she's an amazing young woman. Of all the people that have contacted me, and I've talked to people from all over the country, I can count on one hand the people that were serious. And I can say that Kelly is the only one that has gone the distance, the only one. So you need to applaud her as an Alaskan citizen. Anyway, thank you very much for your time and listening, and I will stay on hold in case you have questions.
Thank you, Robin, for your testimony and sharing that story and for all the work you're doing on this very important issue. And if we're ready, Kelly, are you ready? Or you want to wait a minute? Okay. We can take a brief at ease. Call the meeting back to order. We're going to bring Kelly Roy up, who came down from Anchorage. Thank you, Kelly, for coming down to testify before this committee.
Thank you for having me today.
When you're ready, just take your time and give your testimony, please.
Okay, so around 3 years ago.
If you could state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry.
All those formalities.
Kelly Roy, and I'm from Anchorage.
Thank you.
Okay. So around 3 years ago, I was driving into work. It was a normal day. And there was another driver on the road that day. They had an unsecured load. I didn't really think much of it at the time, and I had no idea how much it was about to affect my life. The truck's load suddenly came apart. It was a mixture of trash, debris, but the biggest object was a trash can, the kind that you put at the end of your driveway. And it just flew right at my windshield. And the next thing I remember is being in an emergency room and a police trying to ask me questions. I was told that my car rolled 4 times and that the fire department had to cut me out of it. I had broken bones, bruises all over, but what almost killed me was a massive blow to my skull. I had brain bleeding both inside and outside of my brain. And as Robin stated, brain bleeding that happens on the inside of the brain has a survival rate of about 30%. I survived that, but not without consequence. I don't think I could come up with words to explain how a brain injury feels. I can only tell you what I had suddenly lost. I couldn't walk across the room without falling over. I couldn't hold a fork or brush my hair. I couldn't even tell my father, who's sitting in this room right now, that I was going to be okay, or that I loved him, because so much of my communication was suddenly damaged. It's been a few years, and I'm actually still in therapy. I've been fighting for a long time to get back everything I've lost. And for what? Because someone couldn't secure their stuff. They couldn't secure their loan. The worst part about all that was that the driver had never stopped. And they just kind of left me there, whoever they were. They left deciding that my life was worth less than all that trash that they didn't bother to tie down. I tried to get financial assistance because brain injuries are quite expensive. And I had called in. Someone had suggested that because the driver had not stopped, that I might be eligible for crime victim compensation. And I wasn't, because what that driver did for Save Alaska is considered a littering fine, a citation, and not anything criminal, and they couldn't help me. And it's why I'm here before you today. That 5 minutes not spent to secure a loan, people pay for with their lives and the lives of the people they love. That 5 minutes that driver didn't spend, I have paid for with the rest of my life. I paid for something that is entirely preventable. Entirely preventable. A person chooses not to secure their loan, just as a person chooses to get behind the wheel of a car drunk. This bill will educate and remind every person how dangerous an unsecured loan really is to everybody on the road. This bill will protect everyone in this room and hopefully every Alaskan in the state from these negligent drivers and hold these negligent drivers accountable for a choice that has hurt and killed so many people. I ask you today that you help me make this change, and you help me change a law that could not protect me and cannot protect any of us in this room. I thank you for listening to my story, and I'm very grateful to be here, and thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you, Kelly, for your testimony. We have questions from the committee. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for your courage in being here today. We appreciate it very, very much. Were you ever able to track down the driver of that vehicle that hit you and left, or excuse me, where the load hit you and they left the scene?
Through the chair, no, I was not.
Never. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Sorry.
Any other questions? Representative Drummond?
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Roy. I really appreciate your testimony. When did this occur?
February 16, 2015.
You appear to be doing amazingly well. Bless your heart. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will do what I can to make sure this law. I'm a yes vote, Mr. Chair. I don't have to know the rest of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Clement.
Thank you for coming here and telling your story. It's never easy to come down to Juneau and testify in front of committees, and I really appreciate your taking the time to come. As we were talking about the interesting challenges of making a criminal offense that will withstand scrutiny by the courts, I think is at the top of the list of why Representative Kopp and I particularly are kind of having these exchanges about how do we deal with this mental state issue, because we know for many years that it's important to make it to get it right, because the last thing you would want is a statute that the later the courts come back and say, well, those guys in the legislature, the men and women, they tried their best but they didn't get it right, and so we're already sitting here going back and forth talking about that very issue, and I can assure you that this is a real issue. We've not only you, but the woman from Seattle and her experience, and I think all of us have had experiences when rocks flying off. I'm a bicyclist myself, and when trucks come by sometimes and things fly off the load, and we have to worry about that, and it's a concern for everyone, and so I'm glad you're here, and thank you for having the courage to be here, and I agree with Representative Drummond for what you went through. You're doing really, really well. I know the path is long, but doing well.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah, so I echo everybody's comments about your courage and our appreciation to you for your testimony. You've helped clarify an issue that's very important. Did you ever talk to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board?
I did not talk to the board, no.
Okay, because there's at least two criminal offenses in the law that apply to what happened to you. That you are the victim of a crime, both of reckless endangerment and reckless driving. And I firmly believe you are eligible for compensation on expenses incurred. And I would just encourage you to, you know, maybe somebody didn't give you good advice, or but that is what that board is there for. And we're going to fix this law so, as Representative Klayman says, it can withstand scrutiny. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming down and for your testimony and for sharing your story with us. I know it's not easy. And thank you, Robin Abel online, for sharing your story. And both of you obviously know each other as well. And it's good to get this issue and put some stories and faces behind it as well. And as Robin said, it's about awareness and getting people changing their behavior and not just increasing penalties. But we want to do what's right for the future and help those that were affected by it.
Kelly, thank you for coming. It's young people like you that make Alaska strong.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease, and then we'll come back with House Bill 2. We're going to also set aside this bill right now, take a brief at ease, and come back with Representative Kopp's bill. To order. Our next order of business is House Bill 263, Transportation Services for Hunters. Intention today is introduce the bill, answer questions from committee members. We have a few people online. Answer questions and possibly testify. And to present the bill, we have Representative Knopp and his staff, Jamie Jones. If you can identify yourself for the record and present your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Jones for the record and work for staff of Representative Knopp. We'd like to thank you for hearing House Bill 263 today. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it does. Alaska statute currently exempts certain air taxis from having to obtain a transporter permit. If they're carrying big game hunters, it's only an incidental portion of their business. If they don't charge more than the usual tariff or charter rate, and they do not advertise big game hunting to services to the public. So HB 263 would add licensed water taxis, meeting the same stipulations as air taxis, to this exemption. According to the Big Game Commercial Services Board, in the 2017 calendar year, there are only 9 new transporter permits issued statewide for a total in the state of 140. To operate a water taxi, you must also comply with the United States Coast Guard and all other state licensing regulations. This exemption would allow individuals to travel to hunting grounds by their choice of water or air taxi. Currently, the water taxi operators incur an additional burden and expense of obtaining another permit that is not required for the exempted air taxi operators. The inclusion of water taxi operators levels the playing field for both means of transportation, providing incidental services to hunters. So we have Representative Knopp and I here to answer questions. We also have the Director of Professional Licensing, and Mark Richards from Resident Hunters of Alaska on the phone to help answer any questions.
Thank you. I have some people from Department of Fish and Game.
So there,
Bruce Dale and Natalie Weber. I don't see a Mark online, but
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gary Knopp, representing District 30. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank the committee co-chairs and the committee members for hearing the bill. Mr. Richards is the president of Rural Hunters of Alaska, and it was in my office earlier, and sure wanted to speak to the bill, and it may be that the time has gotten by him, but he should have been online to speak to this.
I may have seen his name earlier. But.
Yeah, and so I do want to say that we know there are no simple bills that goes through this House, this body. We thought that maybe for a faint moment this might be the very first one till we rolled it out, Mr. Chairman. But it was interesting, some of the questions we engaged with. People had questions when they saw it. We answered them to the best of our ability and really didn't run into any opposition. There might be some online. There were some concerns, and I suppose to express them if they're there. There was also quite a bit of support for the bill. So we will answer questions. But in a nutshell, I do want to emphasize that this is really, for me, about an equality issue. The exemption always was in statute for air taxi operators, and that we want to extend it to water taxi operators as well. We did reach out to, so this statute was rewritten approximately 10 years ago, the transporter statute, and at the time, when we reached out to prior became commercial services board members and other board members, we said, why was water taxis not addressed? And they said, it never come up. It was just simply oversight. It was never a topic of conversation in them. So our request came from a water taxi operator. We reviewed the statutes. We found that they would be the same exact exemption. Nothing changes other than we are including water taxis with the air taxis. And so I'll stop there, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you. We have a couple questions. First, Representative Stutes.
I do have a couple questions. I received a couple concerns, and here's the concerns, and maybe you can address them. With an air taxi service, you fly in, you drop the hunter off, and you fly out. With a water taxi service, there is some concern that you bring them in on the water, you drop them off, and they stay around. They're kind of in that vicinity. So they can almost be scouting out game or looking and going immediately back and picking up the clients, the people, the hunters, and moving them very easily to a new location. So the concern I got was, here are people that could conceivably be guides without a guiding license because of the ease of going in and staying in the area as opposed to, like I said, with an airplane. They fly in, they drop them off, and they fly out.
Representative Stutes, Representative Knopp, through the chair, you know, I guess that's very possible, but I would expect that is probably no different than what a water taxi operator today could do, would do, with a transporter permit. I would say the likelihood of that, if that was to happen, it would definitely be outside the compliance of the exemption, you know, and therefore be subject to penalties. This is incidental to their business. They don't advertise, don't charge a premium, and it's not what they do. It's not what they should be doing. And I guess if they are a scheduled operator, like the Alaska Marine Highway System is, they probably would not be doing that. And if they're an on-demand type water taxi service, hopefully they're on dropping them off and onto their next route or wherever they're heading. So anything's possible, and I won't discount that. I don't think that it's too much of an issue. This really impacts, as staff mentioned, there's only 140 transporter licenses issued around the state, 9 new ones last year, and the department was unable to tell us which ones were air, which ones were snow machines, what was vehicles, what was water taxi. They had no idea what they were issued to. Even the last 9 issued last year, they couldn't tell us to what category of transporters they were issued to. So I don't know how many exist, but when I look at the geographic areas, it's really a little bit south central, Kachemak Bay. Kodiak may have some, take you to Fog Neck or Raspberry. And probably more applicable to southeast as the deer hunters, inner island stuff. But again, as I mentioned, we didn't see any carve out even for the Alaska Marine Highway System, and I know there are hundreds of hunters who drive run the ferry from Homer to Kodiak deer hunting. So I can't say it wouldn't happen, but it'd sure be outside the rules, and then they would be subject to the violations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair.
Co-chair.
That was one of the concerns, and one of the concerns directly related actually to the black bear hunting in Southeast. And there was expressed to me a concern that that might diminish the availability of black bears or reduce the population of the black bears significantly because of the ability. And just like you said, well, there's going to be violators, but the problem is, of course, with the reduced funding, there's no enforcement. So,
through the chair, Representative Stutz, we don't anticipate, and neither the chair of the Board of Game or others we spoke to had anticipated any increased hunting pressure. You know, just a few short years ago, the bag limit for black bears in that area was 5 bears per calendar year. I think it's reduced to 3 bears per calendar year now. So I would say when it comes in regards to additional hunting pressures that I don't expect the water taxi operators who have a current transporter license probably police themselves, restrict clients traveling because of increased hunting pressure. We don't see where this will bring any additional hunting pressure. When I had that conversation with the chair of the Board of Game, his opinion only, not that of the board, was that he didn't think it was an issue, but if it was, the Board of Game would address it like they do every other issue, that either by permits or limitations or seasonal. They have lots of options, lots of tools in their tool belt. So.
Thank you, Representative.
We have Mark Richards online now, but first I'm going to go to Representative Klayman, and then we'll hear from Mark Richards, who's in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a different query. In the second page of the bill, which is not part of your amendment, but there's two ways you get excluded. One is if you're advertising big game hunting services, which I think is partly the concern that Representative Stutz raises about somebody that's actually in the full-on game of doing big game hunting services. But why does the statute exclude advertising transportation services at all? Because I've taken water taxis many times in Prince William Sound, and I can't think of any of the water taxi operators in Prince William Sound that don't have an ad someplace that says, you want to go someplace in Prince William Sound, here's a little flyer, or you go on the Internet. And so I'm curious as to why this statute, and it's on the second page of the bill, it starts out that they can't qualify under this statute if they advertise transportation services, and that seems like it disqualifies probably almost everybody.
To the chair, Representative Klayman, because it was a statute, it was currently written in statute, applied to air taxi operators, and so the exemption was, as they realized when they wrote the statute, that there are incidental carriers, whether it's transport or water taxis, and that have a need to move people, and because you happen to be carrying hunting gear or a rifle, maybe archery would preclude you, I would imagine. If it's hunting associated. So I think the legislature recognized that, wrote that exemption, but to not cross the lines between those who want to take a larger percentage of their business from transporter service but not be guides, they put the exemption in there, and the exemption says you may not advertise as a transporter, you may not charge a premium, and what was the third one? Not charge a premium.
But follow up.
And it's incidental to your business. That was the key to that. It's an incidental portion, a very small portion of your business. So
Follow up,
Representative Klayman.
I may be misreading the statute, but it looks like, at least as I'm reading the statute, but I could be wrong, that if I've got a transportation business and I say I run water taxis in Prince William Sound and I have advertisements that I run water taxi services, at least as I'm reading this statute, just the mere advertising of water taxi service, which is a transportation service, that would mean this statute wouldn't apply. You would be exempted from this statute because you're advertising transportation services. I totally understand the part about if you're advertising big game services, why that would exclude, you know, big signs saying, I'll take you to the hunting grounds. That's a good reason why they would be excluded from this provision, but I don't understand why just mere transportation services are getting excluded.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Kopp.
Thank you. So I think...
Do you want to...
Through the chair, just a brief response. I think if you go down to Section 2 on that last line where it says advertised transportation services or big game hunting services to the public, in the subparagraph, advertised, define an advertised, means soliciting big game hunters to be customers of an air taxi or water taxi operator for the purpose of providing transportation to or from the field. So I think you're allowed to advertise as a transporter, but you can't specifically target the hunting industry, not providing services. So I believe that's how that reads.
Representative Kopp.
He read the section of the bill. It's where advertising is defined. It talks about soliciting big game hunters to kind of clarify what they're going at there.
Do you think my concern is misplaced?
I guess I'm missing something. But this would exempt them from regulation as transportation services. But someone who's a water taxi already, who's advertising as a water taxi, already is following these regulations as a transporter service, right? So why would they then want to be exempt from them if they're already, and I don't know if there's differences for, like Matt says, taking someone in Prince William Sound from point A to point B as a kayaker, from point A to point B as a hunter, is there a different set of regulations?
Well, I think through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I think the reason we're here is because that exemption doesn't apply to water taxis whatsoever. It only applies to air carriers. We're trying to make them inclusive, if I'm understanding your question. So today, anybody running a boat for hire for any purpose cannot take you with your hunting gear anywhere and drop you off, no matter how incidental. So when this come to our attention, it was because of a water taxi operator, he had done that, not being aware of the transporter issue. But it happened to be a repeat loyal customer. And so now after he got in trouble for doing so, it puts his customer base at risk, the loyalty thing. When you have a guy who uses you all the time and all of a sudden you say, no, I can't take you over there and drop you off, although you have done many times for different reasons with the same guy, and now he's got to send him somewhere else. So that was one of the concerns, you know, small people trying to maintain their customer base and loyalty, and very incidental. I've known this man a long time. He's been in business a long time, and this is the first time it's ever come up for him. So,
okay. Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, I would be curious then if this is exempting existing water taxi services, why current water taxi operators would be opposed to this?
To the chair, Representative Stutes. Two conversations I had during this process was, one was a licensed water taxi operator who did have a transporter permit. He was concerned about it, but I don't know if he's on the phone. He may be. I would suspect, because now you're opening up to a little bit of competition for him because he does have a permit. And then we had a conversation from a guy I believe used to have a transporter license but no longer does. And he was not supportive of it either, and I can't really tell you why he was not supportive of it. You know, I just don't know the relationship, the tie there. So,
At this point, I think we'll bring Mark Richards in on the conversation, and then maybe if we have time, we'll ask. I have some questions for Janie McCullough, who's got a new name since last year, I think. So, so let's. Is Mark?
I lost him.
Mark.
He just went to me. Yeah, hi, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you?
We all hear you.
Loud and clear. If you can identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Mark Richards. I'm the executive director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, and I'm here today representing over 1,400 Alaskans and their families. I've also served for the past 2 years on the Transporter Subcommittee of the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and I'm very conversant on these issues. Resident Hunters Alaska wants all hunters to have equal access to the field by commercially licensed and insured carriers, whether by air or water. This bill, as it stands now, only grants the exact same exemption to water taxis, which are licensed and regulated by the Coast Guard, as was originally granted to air taxis, which are licensed and regulated by the Federal Aviation Administration. It only applies to the carriage of hunters as an incidental part of their business. Now, as you've heard, the word incidental is key here in the definitions under AS0854.790. And as we say in our letter, we want to make it clear that whether or not one is a licensed state transporter or not, that doesn't make one any less or more qualified or any less or more safe to carry hunters. We don't believe the state ever should have gotten involved in the transportation services industry to further regulate air and water carriers who transport one specific class of clientele. Please ask yourself why the legislature would ever tell a business how much they can charge, or whether they can advertise, or what type of clientele they can accept. That's what these Title VIII statutes do, and that's just the tip of the iceberg on how they negatively impact resident hunters. Any opposition to this bill as it relates to concerns of hunter crowding or conflicts or wildlife conservation over harvest concerns are the sole authority of the Board of Game to address. I would like to say that, you know, this exemption right now, I think Member Stutes brought it up, some of the comments that she'd been hearing, is that right now, whether or not you're a transporter or you're not a transporter, if you're a water taxi and you stay in the field, wildlife troopers have done undercover operations on both transporters and just six-pack licensed Coast Guard water carriers. It's still illegal to direct a hunter to an animal, to stay around, or to help. You can't butcher. You can't. All of that is already in statute and in law, whether or not you're a transporter or not. There's many other aspects of these Title VIII statutes that we hope will come out in this bill as it moves forward, and we look forward to specifically speaking to those issues to legislators. I'm happy to answer any questions about Title VIII statutes and the entire transporter regulations. It's something I'm well-versed about, and I'll keep it brief and end it there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Any questions, Ms. Richards? I guess I have a question, which maybe Janie McCullough can try to answer, if she could step forward. And we only have a few more minutes left, and we will come back to this bill. We're going to hold it for now. So,
thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Janie McCullough. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Thank you, Janie. I guess my question is, as someone who doesn't use water taxis or hunt big game, and there's some terminology being thrown around that I just, maybe you can help me out, and maybe it's a licensing type question or not, because we're talking about an exemption from regulation as transportation services. So, Representative Klayman gave an example. If I'm in Prince William Sound and I want to take a water taxi, which I assume is a commercially recognized, licensed business, says Joe's Water Taxi or whatever on the side, and I want to go from Whittier to an island, you know, Chiniga or something, yeah. And whether I want to go there for camping, recreation, or big game hunting, is there a difference as far as what that operator needs for any different regulations?
Mr. Chair, I can't profess to be an expert in each one of these licensing types, and I believe Henry Tiffany, the board chair for Big Game Commercial Services, was supposed to be on the line to help answer some of these more technical questions. Can you tell me if he's on the line? If not, I can attempt to try and...
What was the name?
Henry Tiffany?
No.
No.
I
believe that they have to have a transporter's license if they transport hunters to a location at this time.
Okay, so I guess my question is, a transporter license is different than the license that a water taxi operator would need. I mean, do they already have a transporter license?
We don't regulate water taxis.
I guess that's the Coast Guard or
something.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's my confusion, and maybe Representative Knopp can help me with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I can help you, but I can remember back in the 80s, so I want to say also in this process, Mr. Chairman, that we had conversations about the whole transporter issue. But I can remember, and a lot of advocation for it to just completely go away, the transporter licenses from air taxi operators people who have them, people who don't have them, nobody really saw the necessity in them. But I recall, Mr. Chairman, back in the 80s, the conversation around transporter license, and the reason this got implemented at that time, as I recall, is because we had a lot of non-resident hunters coming to the state thinking they were booking guide services, and all they were doing is flying in and dropping off, and there was some real confusion about what services were being provided. And that was the impetus for this transporter license, is to define between who is being guided and who is just being dropped off type services. And so it's growing over the years. And so if that helps you whatsoever. But so that was a designation for having to have advertising, doing the business that, you know, we know where the game is, we'll take you there, drop you off, and that's it. Unlike a guide who'll stay with you and help you harvest and lead you. So
okay.
I help you.
Okay. Thank you. I guess there's more to be discovered on this issue, at least as far as I'm concerned. But thank you, Janie. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside. It's 3-0-0, and we will adjourn this meeting. Thank you.